Today's episode is brought to you by our sponsoring partner, the Campaign for Black Male Achievement. CBME is a national membership network that's built a vibrant community of over 5,700 members and more than 2,700 organizations that's been working together over the past decade to build beloved communities across America where Black men and boys are healthy, thriving, and enabled to achieve their fullest potential. If you're interested in learning more, hop on over right now to tbpod.com/partners and consider joining the membership or donating to help them scale the impact of this growing field of Black male achievement.
You're listening to the Trailblazers.fm podcast, where we'll explore the stories of today's successful Black professionals, entrepreneurs, and leaders. Join us to access the knowledge, resources, and tools of these accomplished professionals and come away with the know-how, confidence, and motivation you'll need to blaze your trail. And now, here's your host, Stephen A. Hart.
Hello and welcome to an all new episode of the Trailblazers podcast. This is the last week in our September series featuring and celebrating Black male achievement. Whoever's listened to all of these episodes with me and you're loving all of it, I want you to shoot me a tweet or maybe hit me up on Instagram in the DMs right now. Our handle on both Twitter and the gram is at TBPod. You can also find me at Stephen A. Hart. Let me know that you're loving this month's episodes and how it has impacted you. Today, we're having a conversation with a very special past guest of the podcast, Dr. Pamela Jolly of Torch Enterprises. And joining her are two amazing brothers, Mr. Christopher Rutherford and Mr. Richard Grundy. I know some of you might have missed our initial conversation that Dr. Jolly and I shared. So I asked CBME's CEO, Mr. Sean Dove, to help me introduce Dr. Jolly. Sean, tell us a little bit about Dr. Pamela Jolly.
Wow, Dr. Pamela Jolly. Stephen, I first met Dr. Pamela Jolly at a conference in Omaha, Nebraska in September 2014 and first heard her talk about the narrow road and building legacy wealth and building wealth our way. And she has changed my life, got her book, just started tweeting with her. And at the time, we were negotiating the spinoff of the Campaign for Black Male Achievement out of the Open Society Foundations, but I knew that I had to work with her. Fast forward 4 years later, we had launched together the Detroit Black Male Equity Initiative. This is a woman that will tell you that she loves three things: God, business, and Black people, in that order. And she is really about raising standards, right? And sometimes when the phone is ringing and I see it's Pamela Jolly, I said, I'm not ready for this call because my standards are not there yet. Let me get my standards up so I can answer the call. Seriously, she has just been a friend, a partner, a mentor, and helping for me and the CBMA network to think about business, to think about building wealth and generational wealth. And she got more degrees in the thermometer, but her heart is as huge as this nation. And so I'm just thrilled to call her a friend and a partner.
Thank you so much for that intro, Sean. Let's go ahead and grab a pad and pen, or you can open your favorite note-taking app and let's dive in and receive today's mission fuel from our Trailblazer panel of Dr. Pamela Jolly, Christopher Rutherford, and Richard Grundy. Thank you all for joining in today's conversation.
Grateful to be here, Stephen.
Thank you.
Awesome. Great to be here.
Dr. Jolly, you're first on the podcast, I believe, episode 104 back in January 2018. And Chris and Richard, this is your first time as guests on the show. Welcome. Appreciate having you all here. I'd love to start things off where we often do with our conversations, but I'm going to have put a little bit of a twist on it. I'll probably have Dr. Jolly lead us off and Chris, you can follow and we'll have Richard finish up. But we're wrapping up a month-long series today celebrating Black male achievement. So I'm going to ask you to tell us about a Black male figure, a Black man. Could be someone you know personally or not, right? So it could be your dad, your high school principal, Barack Obama, or Marcus Garvey, right? But tell us who and why you're grateful for those specific Black men.
I'll definitely start. So for those of you who know me, you know that Kelly Miller is one of my favorite Black men on the planet. And he was the first African-American to attend Johns Hopkins PhD program and then went on to be the dean of Howard University. But he was the editor for both Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois. And he didn't believe it was an either or. He believed it was a both and, that it was both vocational and educational instruction that was necessary for us to get further down the road. And he created a middle road. And the middle road was a way for us to work together to be able to build wealth our way. When I think about what he did then, and I think about where we are now, it's still very, very much important for us to figure out ways to collaborate and work together. And Kelly Miller's legacy is definitely a wonderful example of how that can be done.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Chris?
For me, outside of, I guess, the men in my family who were just mostly good men that worked hard to take care of their family and teach us and give us a work ethic, as far as my brothers and I and my cousins, in terms of public figures, it would have to be Marcus Garvey. He was the first person to really, and I read things about Marcus Garvey like when I was in the ninth grade, and understanding his philosophies were the underpinnings of Black nationalism in this country. In a lot of ways, it has informed who I am, how I proceed through my work with understanding of how do we elevate and change the African-American community. So I would have to say, Marcus Garvey has informed. And then after that, it would have to be Malcolm X, but a host of others. After being introduced to Kelly Miller by Dr. Jolly, he's rising up the popularity poll in my book as well, because that was just phenomenal to learn about.
Appreciate that. And Richard.
I'm going to go new school a little bit. And I'm going to lift up the man that campaigned for Black male achievement, Sean Dove. The reason for that is because when I just started this work probably like 4 years ago, I think. And it was this contest called the My Brother's Keeper Detroit Innovation Challenge. And it was the idea of anybody basically coming with some type of idea or platform or project to kind of help Black men in the city. So my organization came with an idea that we felt was pretty fresh and pretty new of combining coding with entrepreneurship. And we actually were named one of those innovation challenge winners to do our work. So I'm just thinking about the people that kind of give newcomers or people that haven't necessarily been in the work a chance to kind of get into the work and really innovate. The other person I'm going to lift up is Sean Wilson, who's, I think he is originally from like Milwaukee. He's done work with Usher's Foundation in Atlanta. And when I met him, he was running Ford's multicultural initiatives in Detroit. And now he's the president of Boys and Girls Club. But he also gave me an opportunity to do something that I really didn't know how to do. But it was the idea I had of running an entrepreneurship program with youth and incorporating technology into it. And he was able to just sit down with us, with our team, because the entire team, of course, we had done coding instruction, but no entrepreneurship instruction. And he sat down with us and said, let's figure it out. I'm excited about the idea, and just supported the idea from then on. After that, I just kind of started to watch him and watch how he treats everybody with respect, even with the amount of influence that he has and still holds, how he treats everybody. So it really taught me, it really gave me lessons on how to be a leader, how to carry myself, but also, just innovating and really reaching high, but also keeping a high level of execution while you're doing that and moving fast. So
appreciate that. This is all gems right here. A great start. So Dr. Jolly and I have had a conversation on this podcast. Again, I'm a reference episode 104 for those of you listening to her for the first time. You want to go back and check that out. But I'll still have you, Dr. Jolly, as well as Richard and Chris, just take a quick minute and give us a minute or two, right? Tell us a little bit about you and your background and what's driving you into work that you're doing right now.
Thanks again. It's hard to believe for 15 years, I've been working in the world of legacy and wealth in the African American community. And so grateful to be able to do it. And about 4 years ago, actually 5 years ago now, because it was the year my father passed away, I met Sean Dove in Omaha with another collaborator of mine, Willie Barney. And I was keynoting his conference. And we just connected right away. And he bought my book. And as you know, anyone who knows Sean Dove, he's the master at tweeting, and I'm not. And so he would tweet out my book. And I finally figured out with a millennial how to directly respond to him and not the whole world. And that really allowed us to connect. And, you know, Sean Dove and the Campaign for Black Male Achievement are 10 years in this beautiful work. And so he has a really sharp, clear view on the pulse of what Black men need to really achieve. And we both concluded that expanding that narrative to include wealth was definitely something we could do together. And so that's how the Black Male Achievement, the Black Male Equity Initiative was birthed. I had had a curriculum based on interviewing over 3,900 African-American men, but it was really merging, you know, what he saw was needed and what I have seen as well into one really succinct program, and then placing it in Detroit, a place where CBMA has worked extensively for quite some time.
Thank you. Chris.
Yeah. So with regard to the Black Male Equity Initiative, what brings me to that piece of my work, working with Black males, I mean, I've been involved in the Black male achievement space. As Sean Dove says, it's nothing new. So for me, it's been at least since 1989 as a teacher, educator, mentor, worked in politics, involved in student activism on campus when I was in college. But particularly what brings me to the Black Male Equity Initiative was CBMA, quite honestly, and was asked by Sean to lead this effort. And at first, I was skeptical and like, we're going to bring Black men together to openly talk about our money problems. Like, no brother is going to admit that he's not handling his business, right? A group of other Black men, you know, we just don't talk that openly about stuff, unfortunately, right? So at first, I was a little skeptical how this would go and how this would work, but really also understanding and realizing because of my history and working in the African-American community, that this is one of our greatest sticking points, right? How do we get to the point of creating long-term sustainable wealth and not these fits and starts that we keep going through as a people where we obtain and then we lose and then we obtain and then we lose. And so I became really intrigued in terms of almost like an experiment. I guess it has been kind of an experiment for all of us as to where this would go. And as time progressed, I just began to really look deeper and deeper into what this really meant and what it could mean for not only Detroit, but for other cities as well. So I've been really excited about pursuing this portion of the work.
I appreciate that. Richard, tell us a little bit about your background before we get a little bit deeper.
Yeah, so my background is I started a nonprofit about 4 years ago called Journey with a couple co-founders. The idea was to train people of underserved communities in coding and entrepreneurship. I'm kind of a person that kind of went through that process. I was a career changer, entered the workforce in 2008 in Detroit. So it was like a triple tough time. And I was in sales and marketing. So I just kind of wanted a skill set that I owned that nobody could take away from me, where I could generate income pretty easily. So I moved to New York, went to the coding boot camp, and it just blew my mind on how it showed us how to create things, more so than just coding, right? Being able to be a creator and really own your path or your life. It was a different level of freedom. So I worked in New York probably for about a year and a half, but the Detroit that I left in 2010, I spent some years in Atlanta, but the Detroit I worked in 2010, I was thinking like if the people back home knew about this, the sky would be the limit. So moved back, started Journey, and have been working with young Black males ever since. The first grant that we ever had was from the Campaign for Black Male Achievement. So they hold a high spot in my heart already because they gave us our first opportunity to kind of run our program and then continue to expand it. So I already had good relationships there. And yeah.
Good stuff. So Dr. Jolly, I'm going to bring you back because I'd love to maybe have us talk about, and if you want to expand any more on the Black Male Equity Initiative, but I know your heart, your passion, your purpose is legacy wealth, right? So bringing that into the Black Male Equity Initiative, what was your thoughts around the target, the avatar, if you will, right? We know this was designed for Black men, but who are the ideal participants for the program and kind of what were you and Sean thinking as sort of an end goal for this cohort, this initial one in Detroit?
Yes. So the Black Male Equity Initiative's programming is all based on Narrow Road. And so it's a custom tailored curricula specifically for Black men. And it stems on, you know, the core primary finding of my research was that it takes three generations to build legacy wealth and only one generation to lose it. And so when looking at the target, it was important that the cohort was cross-generational. it also had to be cross socioeconomic levels. So we had both accredited investors and non-accredited investors. We had to have different income levels because it had to be relevant, not just for one segment of our Black male community, for all segments of our Black male community. So the desire is to create a brotherhood of Black men that are committed to wealth, recognizing that there are brotherhoods of Black men across the country, whether it's your fraternities, the 100 Black Men, your church membership groups, your not-for-profit groups. But this is a group that could benefit all the groups that each man is a part of because it's focused specifically on wealth creation and equity, looking at it from four different perspectives: legacy, your cultural equity, genius, really, which is your intellectual equity, your finances, which is your human equity, and then our community, which is your social equity. So once you have a stronger understanding of equity, which is really wealth stored up, you can be a wealth builder because you recognize the wealth within yourself.
I love that. So, Chris, I'm going to bring you into the fold. You kind of talked about Sean kind of almost nudging you into the program, right? But what were you hoping to gain by being part of this cohort?
Like, first, if we could just get, you know, we started off with about 20, 25 men, that we could just get men in the room, like, who would be interested in this, right? Mm-hmm. So for me, it was like baby steps. As I said, I was skeptical in the beginning that we could even bring men together. And we kind of, you know, we first targeted men and then we kind of did an all call of who we were trying to invite into the room, and just really humbled by the brothers that did show up at our request because we didn't know a lot about it, right? We couldn't explain exactly what this journey would be on. It'd be kind of, it was mostly like, you know, come and trust us, right? And even I couldn't really in-depth explain, except that we were going to do a deep journey into wealth and equity. And of course, there's, you know, in any city, there's a lot of people who talk about how to build wealth, right? But the thing that really sold me on this is it's not just how to build wealth for yourself, right? We see all kinds of self-help books and documentaries and anything, you know, turn on PBS even, there's self-help stuff out there. But how do you build wealth for yourself, for your family, but also for your community and keep it? Right. And so those were the things that kept echoing in my mind in terms of why this was important and why this was different. And so even in the very beginning, I think would really, you know, there was this touch on these historic people and being such a sort of a novice historian. I'm always thinking that if we don't start with our historical context, I even created some programs for youth that says you have to start with the historical context and move forward. And what really sold me was like the first introductions of the meetings that we had, the first phone call, when we did this historical analysis of who we were as a people with a lens toward equity, wealth, and capital, and not just from a simple historical context, but, you know, how wealth is built in this country, how it applies to us, and what we need to do to move forward. I think that had me hook, line, and sinker, you know, after that first meeting. I'm going, okay, this is going to be all right. And I almost wish I had invited some other people to it because I was like, I knew some people that were like deep around, you know, really wanting to be a part of it. But we really didn't know, you know, I was open, you know, I'd read Dr. Jolly's history. I knew she was a very thorough and capable scholar and just had the passion to lead us through this work, but, you know, didn't have any great expectations going in until we had our first meeting.
Mm. So I have a question, and either of you feel free to chime in, but did you guys actually succeed? Like Dr. Jolly just touched on wanting that diverse cohort. Were you guys able to succeed at that?
Absolutely. As she said, we had, as people like to say, from the streets to the suites. We had brothers who were, you know, established economically, maybe not in the best light, or maybe not as well after the end of the course, maybe not as well as they thought they were, but felt like they were established economically. Some own their own businesses. Some were just now establishing their economics in this world or reestablishing their economics after going through, especially the Great Recession, the way it hit Detroit with the loss of the auto industry, other sometimes personal challenges. But yeah, we had a great cross-section of men realizing that, you know, because it was a year-long intensive that, you know, all brothers wouldn't be able to stay on just because of human, personal, family challenges, business challenges. And so realizing that we would lose a few, but definitely looking for who would be that core group to stay. And I think it remained diverse all the way through the whole process.
Mm-hmm. Richard, you touched on, you know, you're a leader, right? You're building journey. And talk to me about some of the bigger challenges that you experienced kind of navigating your way through the program. Some of what Chris just touched on here, you know, it's not always comfortable for brothers to talk money. and openly discuss wealth. What were your experiences and challenges in that regard?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that just in terms of trust, the program was set up where we tackled that head on and got all of the things out in the open that may be a hesitation for anybody to invest together, which is, you know, obviously was part of it was trust. I think that was probably the only challenge that we probably would have had, but it's kind of hard getting so many people together at the same time. We had a Facebook group where we were able to connect with each other. People had different events where we would connect one off. For me, and it's not a challenge, but I think that the one-on-one with Dr. Jolly and I kind of, even before the cohort, you know, people told me how dynamic of a person Dr. Jolly was as I was filling out the application and why it was important to kind of apply. So that was, I don't know if that settled everybody else, but that settled me as far as how to prioritize this among other things that I had going on. I think, you know, just that time commitment was probably the only thing. And then we had homework as well, right? So it's not just meeting once a quarter, but it's 2 calls a month. You know, scheduling that when you're a busy person is definitely not easy, but you just got to figure out how to prioritize it and just going at things with a good mindset too. And it's funny because all the things that I'm mentioning was addressed in the program as far as the growth mindset, things like that.
So important, right? Like mindset is everything. I was having this discussion last week. It's a constant theme, even for me on this podcast, having interviewed over 150 people, I can tell you the common thread with success has a lot to do with mindset and taking action, you know, once you have that clear vision and that positive outlook, kind of what you hope to accomplish, right?
Yeah.
As I say that, what did success look like for you coming in and how did that change kind of coming out of it, right?
For sure. So just the name of the program, right, or the way it's described, building wealth, whoever's not wealthy, who's not going to sign up for that or be interested in something like that, right? Again, I mentioned earlier that I was someone who came into the workforce during a recession. So I came in when all of the retirement was changing, benefits were changing, all of that, everything that was sold to us during college, all of those things were pretty much wiped out. As I started to advance in my career, I kind of knew I'm a social entrepreneur more than anything. I'm not going to have a retirement, right? So it was very important for me to kind of look at ways that I could build it. So it was right up my alley. I remember one of the questions that I read in the application, though, that really follows, I think, what my true calling is, and this program helped me to realize that too, was that, will you be able to share this information with others in Detroit, right? So I work with youth and kids, and it's not just a one-off situation. It's a situation where I may have worked with this youth 4 years ago, and we're still communicating. I've sent a couple of youth to Black History College tours that aren't in my program anymore. So I'm kind of connected to their success and connected to passing on the information. What I learned from the program, I thought I was just going to pass on a lot of stuff as far as how to build wealth. What the program really helped me to do was to build a foundation of taking an audit of what I was good at, right? The things that I was making mistakes on as far as wealth, as far as bad habits, spending habits and things like that. But then the other thing was who I actually was. So we took a African ancestry test. And it's so funny that we did that because the first conversation I had with Dr. Jolly was like, when I lived in New York, I'm living around all these different international people who know where they come from, know all these different things about themselves. And I knew nothing about myself other than I was Black and I lived in Michigan. My father was born in Detroit, but spent some time in Louisville, and my mother's from Jamaica. That's all I knew, right? So this program helped us to really take an audit of who we were in terms of bad habits, what our parents were doing, grandparents were doing, bad habits, good habits, looking at what people should do it just historically, but then who we are as well. And I think that's, for me, that's what success is, what I can pass down to my students. That's what I'm thinking about passing down to my students. Like anything else, if you know, you see all these athletes, I'm just using athletes as an example, you know, not to generalize them, but if someone's not prepared to receive $1 million, $10 million or whatever, you're going to, you know what I'm saying? They're going to wreck it. Just like if you don't know how to drive a Ferrari or drive, you're going to wreck it. So I think building that foundation is something that was really good and was a huge thing that I got from this program.
I love it. Chris, you have anything you want to share to add to that?
Just specifically, I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot that I gained in terms of just kind of, as we moved through it, just kind of shaking me. And it was like, hey, dude, get control of your financial resources, because they weren't in control. And there were periods in my life when I was really diligent about it, and just through life circumstances, that discipline had kind of fallen off, right? And then even beyond that, something said in me, probably by our second or third intensive, that just resonated about my upbringing, right? Mm-hmm. And how we perceived wealth and how we were taught to work hard, but we were taught to work hard to break even, right? Not to become wealthy and to pass on generational wealth, you know? And had always, you know, everybody defends how they were raised by their parents, right? You know, my mother taught me the right things, taught me to budget, but not in a growth mindset, right? Not in a growth of your budget so you can build, hand down, build. It was more of, you know, save for a rainy day in case, you know, a recession comes, right? So you'll have a few pennies to live off of. But I think that was huge for me because it also determined for me some of the decisions I had made throughout my life. Like, it allowed me to reflect on, you know, when I think back, like, God, that wasn't a smart financial decision. Why did I make that decision? And it also allowed me to reflect, like, well, you know, that was kind of your upbringing, not in a bad way, but it was the best that they knew, right? Given their circumstances, my father being raised in rural Georgia and almost being forced to move up here, you know, because of racism, with his parents bringing him up here when he was 10, my mother growing up in a little rural suburb known as Royal Oak Township, both, you know, just poor people who had to figure it out themselves growing up in Detroit through the 40s, 50s, and 60s until, you know, the auto industry really started paying, you know, good wages for Black people. And so for them, and then even that, you know, even though they had, you know, my father worked in the auto plants, you know, which paid good wages, it was still a matter of, you know, what they say about African Americans, you know, last hired, first fired. So it was always still never certainty about where, you know, our economic resources would come from. So it was just work as hard as you can, prove yourself efficient so that, you know, you don't get axed when it's time for the company to downsize. But it was never about this belief that you could take this, build upon it. You know, the hope was a good education would, you know, allow you to make that extra money or not have to work so hard. But the truth is that, you know, as there's some people say, it's not how much you make, it's how much you keep. And so, like, you can have a good education, as he alluded to, get $1 million, but if you don't know what to do with it, you know, it's gone as fast as it came. So I think some of those pieces were really what resonated with me the most, right? It was that internal growth. I mean, you know, we've all been taught how to do budgets, most of us anyway. Sticking to budget is a different discipline, but nevertheless, you know these things, you've heard these things, you see these things, but actually getting to the point where you practice them, you know, and not, like I said, just to get to a point where, you know, well, I've saved some money. No, I've saved wealth for my daughter, right? So that was the most important thing. My daughter came to me with a business idea that was a little more complicated than any business idea I ever had. And I didn't know where to start, right? It was almost embarrassing, right? She calls me her, you know, she tells me I'm better than Google most of the time. But when it came down to, Dad, I want to build this for the future for myself and for the family, I'm passionate about it, I was like stumped, you know, and had to just start calling people to ask questions. And I'm still stumped, right? Thank God she's a lot smarter than me and knows how to persevere, but it's almost like I couldn't go to the next level with it. And through this conversation with Dr. Jolly, I've been able to like take back and begin to take baby steps and even walk my daughter through baby steps as we move this idea that she has in her business. But it all, the courage to do that and the foundational information of how, and not just, oh yeah, go try this business, but how, let's figure out how to build this business so that it has longevity, so that, you know, we'll have something for the family or yourself, you know, as we move forward. How can I contribute with my social capital, right? Learning what capital is, the different types of capital that we all have. So those are some of my, like, there's been many takeaways, but I think the deeper part was a revelation of how I viewed money based on my upbringing.
I love all that you guys are sharing. And Dr. Jolly, I'll bring you back in. But, you know, I also love, Chris, that you touched on this last piece here. And I'm sure this is kind of what, from my conversations with Dr. Jolly, it's that intergenerational piece, right? That connecting generation to generation and doing it together, right? Dr. Jolly, you've told me in the past that you learn best in a classroom, right? What have you learned having looked at this cohort and, you know, worked through, as I think either Chris or Richard talked about an experiment, right? Like, as you guys worked through this first cohort, what was the bigger lessons that you took away leading this group?
Love how you remember that. Yes. One of the things that I love most about Sean is that he keeps it moving. You know, he always is able to reconcile, look, this is our pilot, this is where we're starting, and we're keeping it moving. And so having a collaborator that says, look, this is going forward. I learned that, you know, seeing is believing is what I saw in my research, but I really saw it here, where you have amazing men in a cohort that are demonstrated with Christopher and Richard on the phone, but you also have some men who have to see it to believe it. And so the fact that we kept on moving and we kept on moving forward and we did not stop, it really was a beautiful way to show that we all don't get there the same time, but if we keep moving, there is a momentum that happens. And there's these first movers, these second movers, and there's these third movers. And then there's these stragglers, because, you know, one of the beautiful things about CBMA is that nobody gets left behind. And so, you know, when we look at the Black Male Equity Anthology, which I'm so proud about because it's the synthesis of many of the men in the cohort who went the distance, you know, who were able to review what they went through and write it down. I mean, they wrote the vision, they made it plain, we published it. And now it can go out across the world to motivate people, other Black men, about taking a similar journey, but just introspection of themselves. So, you know, the lessons here, this was a classroom for me. You know, I love Black men. God started with Black men and so did I. But I just really started to understand aspects of Black male learning and embodiment of principles that I just know has such a fertile ground for areas all throughout the country.
Love it. As you look ahead, what's next? What's the next chapter?
So we launched the Black Male Equity Initiative Anthology at Anthony Smith's of Cities United's convening a few weeks ago in Hampton at the celebration of the 400th year anniversary. We had a wonderful dinner there, and the convening was so amazing. It had mayors and leaders from all over the country there. And so we were able to really share the vision. And Christopher Rutherford was there, Richard Grundy was there, Robert Johnson was there, as well as Stephen Vassar and Sean and myself. And so there's been a lot of momentum and interest across the country of how do we bring this to our location and our area. So what's next is exploring those different ways in which we can do that. We're hosting a Black Male Equity Initiative webinar series. We had our first one last week with Sean and myself, where we did an overview of the program. And the next ones will go through the four aspects of the programming with the cohort members, as well as some of the facilitators. We are extending the cohort to include now Louisville for next year. And we are looking for exploring specific ways in partnership with the inaugural cohort of how we can deepen what we did in Detroit. So deepen and expanding. Last year was a year of demonstration and preparation. This is a year of invitation. And so I'm not married to method, I'm married to outcome. And so we know the cohort experience is really powerful, but as Richard said, it's very time intensive. So looking at alternative ways in which maybe a city doesn't have the bandwidth or the budget for a year-long exploration, but maybe we could do a town hall or a day and a half intensive with some online follow-up with our inaugural cohort and our facilitators. So we're in exploration mode. And we welcome Black men who resonate with what we're talking about here today and in the webinar series to reach out to us on the website and share your thoughts about how we can make this a reality, because we do need to expand the narrative of Black male achievement to include wealth creation and have Black men really own their relationship with themselves and their definition of wealth so they can pursue it in their lifetime and pass it on for generations.
I love that. And I don't know, Pamela or maybe Chris, if either of you could share the website where our listeners could learn a bit more about Black Male Equity Initiative.
The first step is to go to thebmei.com/webinar2. And then if you do just Google Black Male Equity Initiative or bmei.com, you should get our main page. The other thing is that you can definitely go on the Campaign for Black Male Achievement and sign up to become a member. And we will follow up with you about what we're doing. Our anthology is on sale on Amazon, both the digital version as well as the hard copy. I'm a bit biased. The hard copy is hardcover, all color, absolutely beautiful. Pages and pages of beautiful Black men talking about wealth. It just doesn't get any better than that. So I would definitely encourage you to do one of each.
Good stuff. I'll make sure I link up all of that on our show notes page over at tdpod.com. We're beginning to wrap up. Just wanted to maybe ask each of you to share Pamela touched on Twitter being a love of Sean Dove, and many of us are connected on Twitter, but feel free to share your handle and how we might stay in contact with you. Dr. Jolly, I'll maybe start with you.
So Twitter is at Pamela Jolly. I also have a Facebook group, which is Jolly Journey, the Jolly Journey, which would be a good way to do it as well.
Chris.
Yeah, I'm still a digital immigrant, so you can find me on Twitter. It's at CRutherford360. And then obviously on Facebook at Chris Rutherford. So, and then as Dr. Jolly said, to learn about all things Black Male Achievement and to join and become a member of the Campaign for Black Male Achievement, you can go straight to cbma.org/join.
Richard, how we stay connected with you, brother?
My handle is at Mr. Rich Grundy. So at MRRICHGRUNDY. Twitter and Instagram. I'm a little bit more active on Instagram probably than Twitter.
Sounds good. Sounds good. Listen, last question I'll direct to Dr. Jolly. What's one action that you'd like our community to take this week that's going to help them to blaze their trail?
So there's a lot going on in the world. If we look at a macroeconomic perspective, there's a lot of changes happening and potential shifts in our economy. With the last quarter of the 2019, 400-year anniversary of us from being the asset to owning the asset. To blaze your trail, take inventory of where you are, determine where you want to be, and write a financial projection to get there. Let's be real about the business of yourself. The primary purpose of business is to build wealth. And so if you're out there and you're listening and you know you're not building wealth for yourself, the reality is that you don't own yourself the time that you do. So let's get real serious about financial position. It's never too late to start, but the earlier, the better.
Thank you all very much for being part of this conversation. God bless you guys, and we'll connect again soon.
God bless you too, Stephen. And thank you for what you do.
Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you.
I'm Steve Nehart, and you've been listening to the Trailblazers.fm podcast. If you're not yet doing so, consider following Trailblazers.fm on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and feel free to connect with me over on LinkedIn. Whenever you're posting stories or social media posts about Trailblazers.fm, be sure to use the hashtag TBPod and hashtag Mission Fuel. We'll be able to see you, and I'll be able to show some love. And in case you're not aware, our show notes for all our episodes can be found on our website over at tbpod.com. Now, if today was your first time listening, I just want to say big ups, enough respect for checking us out. You've made this Jamaican guy really happy that you're here with us today. And I'd love your help with keeping this Black excellence flowing each and every week. So if you haven't yet subscribed, hop on over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Search trailblazers.fm and subscribe, rate, and review us there. Be sure to browse through some of our past episodes. There are more than 150 published episodes now, and a little something is out there for everyone to help keep the knowledge flowing. We grow when you, as part of our Blazer Nation community, shares and invites your friends and family to listen to an episode you think might impact them most. We believe that someone listening to these inspiring stories are going to be moved to make significant changes that have generational impact for many others, both now and well into the future. Don't miss next week's episode. New episodes are released each and every Monday morning at 5 a.m. Eastern. Blazer Nation, go out today and find a way to rise above, go way beyond, and keep blazing your trail.